The Guardian.
Hallo, Sie hören gerade die Sonderausgabe des Science Weekly, aufgenommen in Deutschland.
Hello, you're listening to a special edition of Science Weekly recorded in Germany.
Hello, I'm Alok Jha.
And I'm Ian Sample.
Im Postcard diese Woche.
On this week's podcast.
We've been let out of the studio and the country as part of the Guardian's Europe Month. This week the focus is Germany, and that's where we've been dispatched.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, yep.
We've been given a couple of days to run around and seek out some of the most interesting science the country has to offer, and the amazing work researchers here are up to that we don't often get to hear about.
It will take from now on some 10 minutes or so to achieve the initial position for releasing the shot.
We're heading to Darmstadt, Bremen and Cologne to investigate everything from microgravity, a famous Archaeopteryx, to fruit flies. We even speak to a satellite.
I believe somewhere we do have a small horse in a jar.
James Bond's lounge.
The space shuttle. Yeah, okay.
We'll also look at the nuts and bolts of how it all works here. What's the funding and how all the various institutes fit together?
Network cluster. Cluster network. Okay, you can break track.
For example, if the walrus would decide to damage the antenna.
The Mona Lisa of the fossil world.
Does it ever go wrong?
But what better place to start than the capital, Berlin, where some of the most famous Germans helped lay the foundations of science.
Well, I would call Ernst Mayr certainly one of the central figures. He is known as being one of the leading evolutionary biologists.
I would go for someone called Willy Hennig, and he basically invented a technique which we call cladistics.
The famous scientist for me, of course, is Alexander von Humboldt, because I have a strong relationship to him because I studied at the Humboldt University in Berlin. So, and he was an explorer and someone who went out in the field and collected.
I think I would think of Leibniz. It's a mathematician, and he is the father of the binary system.
Einstein.
Stresemann, Rentsch, and Mayr are certainly the German systematists that we should be more proud of.
People like Ruska or Ardenne, maybe nobody knows about him, but there was the inventor of the electron microscope.
I'm outside the Natural History Museum in Berlin. A grand Gothic building, probably what you think a museum should look like. It's a bit smaller than you might imagine, but still huge colonnades as you walk in. I'm here to see Matthias Glaubrecht. He's the head of science, but also he looks after the mollusks and other squidgy creatures here in the museum.
Mein Name ist Matthias Glaubrecht. Herzlich willkommen im Naturkundemuseum in Berlin. So mollusks are what I would call everything that fits on a pizza and doesn't look like a crab. So this is bivalves, snails and, cephalopods. So,
The museum itself is obviously a public space. There are kids all over the place. There are people walking in and out of dinosaur exhibits and all sorts of things. But it's a fairly major research institution as well for basic science. Tell us a bit about the kind of work that goes on.
Well, I always compare that to the showcase of a bookseller. What you normally see in a natural history museum is the exhibit, which is maybe only 5% of the space and definitely not more than 5% of the specimen, the objects, the real natural history objects that you see. So if you think about a natural history museum, you should think about seeing the showcase, which is in front of the museum. You see big dinosaurs where the kids run around, where the visitors can actually see what we have. But we are a research institution, and the bulk, the major scientific work and the scientific objects are actually behind, like in a big magazine in a library where you have all these books stored in the basement.
Mit diesem Sexualsystem der Pflanzen gelang mir so mancher Kuh. So konnte ich selbst Pflanzen.
My name is Jana Hoffmann. I'm working at the Natural History Museum in Berlin, and I'm doing my PhD on recent brachiopods, dealing with systematics. A brachiopod looks like a bivalve, but isn't. It has two valves. I'm working for the Biodiversity Heritage Library for Europe. That's a European project funded by the European Commission with 28 partner institutions, and we are trying to compile or digitize content on Biodiversity Heritage Library stuff or publications that can be found in Europe. And we are building an infrastructure at the Natural History Museum in London to store and archive that and make it accessible for the public and the scientific users.
We wandered into the main hall of the museum, and just like in the museum in London, there's a huge dinosaur that greets you on the way in. Now, I'm here with Jason Dunlop, one of the curators. Jason, what is the dinosaur we're looking at?
This is Brachiosaurus, and it is actually the tallest complete mounted dinosaur in the world. It's part of a group of dinosaurs which were discovered in the 1920s in Tanzania. And this was a major expedition from the museum here, that they actually literally took a hill apart and took all the dinosaur specimens that they found out. And now we've rebuilt the best ones here as a centrepiece for our dinosaur hall.
Just behind the Brontosaurus is something quite interesting. It's just a sort of very discreet little black room. Tell us a bit about what's in there. It's something that I think people might be familiar with.
Yeah. Where we're going now is to the Archaeopteryx. And this is what we like to say is the Mona Lisa of the fossil world. It's the Berlin specimen of Archaeopteryx. There's only been about 8 or 9 specimens found in the whole world. And this is what many people would say is the best one. It's the most complete one. It's the most attractive looking one. It's the one you've almost certainly seen if you've ever seen a picture of Archaeopteryx in a textbook or something. It is beautifully sort of spread-eagled, if you'll excuse the phrase, on the slab here. And what's important here is we've recently had a new safety box put in here, and so we can actually display the original real specimen.
Okay. Let's carry on moving into some of the other rooms. What else do you think would be good to describe?
Biodiversity, maybe?
Yeah, let's go. And so what we're looking at here is a huge glass case filled with hundreds of birds and mammals, and just stuffed and presented very, very beautifully, all sorts of colours, parrots, eagles. There's a couple of monkeys over there. There's a seal.
I think the most interesting thing in recently was a paper we published in Nature, actually only last week, where we believe we found something that's very close to the great-great-granddaddy of all the creepy crawlies. So it's a sort of simple animal which still has jointed legs, like spiders, crabs and insects and so on. And we discovered an interesting specimen from China. It's about 500 million years old. And we think it could be close to the ancestor of all the other arthropods.
Now, this was reported as a walking cactus, wasn't it? Now, what's it got to do with actual cactuses?
It doesn't really have anything to do with the cactus, but when we looked at the fossil, it has a rather strange shape. It has sort of short, spiny legs, and we thought at first it looks a bit like a cactus. It's not a cactus, it's just the nickname we gave it.
Why do they have to be snakes? I hate snakes, and there's hundreds of them in jars all around us.
Listeners might wonder why someone with an English accent is working in a German museum. How long have you been here?
I've actually been here 13 years now.
And what made you come? Was it something specific about the museum itself?
Not as such. I mean, Berlin has a very good reputation. The museum also has a good reputation. But to be brutally honest, they offered me a job. And at my age back then, to be offered a permanent position, you'd go anywhere for it. At least in my collection, probably 250,000 specimens.
I mean, it's one of those things we talk about again, isn't it? The British scientists leaving the country, going elsewhere. It's a good thing, of course, to have British scientists all over the place. But you also lose lots of expertise from the UK.
Part of the problem, for example, is that there aren't that many people left in the UK working with spiders. Even my own PhD supervisor has now gone to the United States.
The whole spiders are, is as big as your head. And it's perfect, down to every last hair stuck in the legs.
Right, that's it from my quick visit to Berlin. I'm now going to hop on the S-Bahn and head to a small place near Frankfurt to discover more about the exciting things going on in Germany. Perfect for a geek like me. But for now, over to you, Ian.
Hello, ich heiße Ian Sample, and I'm in the northwest of Germany, Bremen in fact. I've just stepped off the tram, a few minutes walk from the university here, and I can already see the unusual building I've come to visit. From the outside, it's a fairly ordinary research complex, with one outstanding feature, a huge tower rising up from the building surrounding it. And that is what's brought us here.
Herzlich willkommen im ZARM, im Zentrum für angewandte Raumfahrttechnologie und Mikrogravitation. Welcome to ZARM, the Center for Applied Space Technology and Microgravity. You've just entered the place where you can witness the best microgravity experiments on this planet.
I'm Christian Eigenbrod. I'm the technical director of the Drop Tower Bremen. If you drop an experiment from the top of the tower, and if no outer forces except gravitation works, acts to the experiment, in the experiment you would not feel any gravitational effects. So the reason for a drop tower is to achieve microgravity conditions on ground within the gravitational field of Earth.
So tell me what you've got here exactly. I mean, this is how high is the tower that you use to do these experiments?
This tower is 146 meters high. Inside of this concrete tower, there is a steel tube with an elevation of about 110 meters, and we drop the experiments from 110 meters to the ground. This takes about 4.5 seconds, so this is actually the experiment time. If we have experiments that need longer times, we are now able not only to drop the capsule from the tip of the tower, but to throw it upwards from the lower end of the tower and use the length of the tower twice during the way up and its fall back to the ground. If you would be inside of the capsule, you would not feel the capsule to become slower at the end and turning and accelerating again, because without any acceleration, you would feel microgravity until the deceleration starts.
And now the sun is shining, and that would be an opportunity to go to the top.
There's a lift, don't worry.
Can you go up manually?
You can.
Yeah, I'll see you up there. No, I'd really like to.
All right, here we go. 146 meters by ladder, and I'm lost already.
We can do experiments every day, once, twice, or three times a day. What doesn't work today, we can rework overnight and do it differently the next day, do it better the next day. That's a big advantage. So it's like working in a normal ground-based laboratory. It's not really a space environment with all these restrictions.
So it's actually pitch black here. So I'm going to use my phone as a torch.
A very wide range of experiments, starting from very fundamental questions in fundamental physics, investigating the nature of gravity, for instance. Even doing microgravity research here, we do not really know about the nature of gravity.
I don't mind it being dark, but he did say that there was a possibility of falling if I went wrong.
It spans over physical sciences, fluid physics, or combustion sciences. Combustion is one of the main issues for a drop tower because it happens in short time. But we also perform material sciences and biological and biotechnological experiments in the tower. So the whole range of natural sciences.
92 meters.
The first aspect, of course, is we cannot do manned experiments. That's because of the deceleration of the drop vehicle, which is about 35 times the gravitational acceleration.
This is the top.
Almost.
Everything inside the capsule must be autonomous and remotely controlled. So inside the capsule there is everything, the experimental setup, the control computers, the data acquisition systems, and the telemetry and telecommand systems to send data to ground or to receive commands from ground.
Stupid idea. Wow, look at this. This is like a James Bond sort of James Bond's lounge. It's really cool. This is where you entertain. And how did you get this curving sofa up here? So we have to have a look at this view. Wow. Oh, look, here's some more remains of a bird. Here's a little arm, a wing. Oh, and there's a bit more. So your kestrel's been busy.
You were right. He did come down with us.
Yeah. Right, so we're just heading into the basement of the Zarm catapult tower. It's a really narrow wireframe stairwell.
So now we are underneath the drop tower, just between the foundation posts of the drop tower. What we see here is the catapult machine, which allows us to
not only drop the capsules from the top of the tower, but to throw it upwards and wait for the capsule to turn and fall back. So this allows us to have doubled the microgravity time as compared to normal dropping.
So this is the launch pad?
This is actually the launch pad, if you want. Yes.
What's that? Is that dangerous?
No, it's not dangerous. We are just preparing a catapult shot, and there are some operations taking on automatically.
You wouldn't want to be down here when it's working, no?
I would not have any doubt that it works properly, but actually I have never been here during operation.
No, sure.
So maybe we should now go to the
control room. I just suspect it would be a bit noisy. You can probably hear it behind me. They're now preparing the tower for an experiment. Come back to me in a few minutes when I'll be in the control room watching as it takes place. In the meantime, let's find out if Alok's made it to Frankfurt.
For the space shuttle, yeah.
Yeah, okay. No problem.
I'm now in a taxi on my way to a place called Darmstadt, which is just about half an hour's drive outside Frankfurt. Darmstadt is the European version of Houston. We're going to a place called ESOC, which I think stands for the European Space Operations Centre. All the satellites, all the missions, anything with an ESA badge is controlled from this complex. Oh, look, we're here. Well, it says ESOC anyway.
Schön.
Dankeschön.
Is it okay?
Yeah.
Good. Prima.
Super. Yeah. It is the European Space Operations Center.
Willkommen am ESOC, dem europäischen...
Hello, welcome to ESOC in Darmstadt, Germany.
In Darmstadt.
And it's a so-called engineering model of the Rosetta spacecraft.
Wow.
So engineering models means that it's basically the one-to-one copy of the spacecraft. The only missing things are the solar panels, obviously, because we don't need them on the ground.
We've stepped out into the glorious Darmstadt sunshine. It's a bit windy. And walking past various little models of satellites, and there's a nice little Ariane 5 just sat on the side over there. We're about to go into the control center. This is what we've come to really see here.
My full name is Dr. Markus Landgraf from the European Operations Center here in Darmstadt. My function here is I'm a mission analyst, so I'm one of those people who calculate trajectories of space missions that go to the planets and all those kinds of things need to be planned, and that's my task here in ESOC.
This is kind of what people might imagine they've seen on TV. It's kind of like a theatre sort of place with rows and rows of computer screens with various labels above them. In front of us all, there are screens with maps of the Earth, and I'm assuming satellite tracks across them. Take us through what the different consoles represent. There's all these different ones, like power, there's AOCS, SOM. What does these all mean?
Right. So this is really the heart of ESOC. So, and for any control center around the world, like in Houston, Texas, or in Moscow, those places are the heart of the control centers. And you have those consoles with a lot of screens. And at those screens, there's a very hierarchical order of people working here. And you need this big team in times where there's critical operations, typically during a launch.
À tous de DDO, attention pour le décompte final.
Here in our main control room, we have kind of three layers. In the back, you have basically the customer and the flight director who is overseeing the whole operation. And you have the ground segment, people who are looking after the ground station.
And how long would a typical mission be monitored from here, from the central command center, before it's passed on to another room?
Depends very much on the mission. Typically for like going to Mars, you would monitor it for a week.
Beautiful, there, Ariane off on her way with just a 24-hour delay, leaving a trail of gold as she rises into the sky over French Guiana at 18:51 local time and right on.
Design of all the doors here. Looks like you're actually in a spaceship with all the curved edges.
My name is Holger Krag. I'm what we call a space debris analyst, working in ESA Space Debris Office here in Darmstadt, in European Space Operations Center.
In these boxes, there's samples of tests demonstrating basically the energy inside objects going around Earth. So this is,
now, I was expecting when we were told we're going to come to a space debris office to literally be in a junkyard of some sort with bits of space station and satellite. We're actually in a quite a tidy office. Tell us what the space debris department does.
Well, I did not show you my office yet, and I won't. Since we are attached to an operational department here, we are looking at the safety of our satellites, and this means we are monitoring close conjunctions between our satellites and other objects that orbit the Earth. And nowadays situation, we have more or less weekly warnings for our satellites, which means we have to take or at least consider counteractions like avoidance maneuvers.
And so these bits of satellites and bits of equipment, how fast are they traveling? What's their potential danger?
Very fast. In order to stay in orbit, an object in these altitudes must move with 7 kilometers per second. So you can imagine that we have collision velocities of up to 14 kilometers per second, so twice that number in head-on cases. And with these velocities, even a small, tiny object of just cherry size will reveal an energy comparable to a grenade exploding.
Now, you've brought some things in from your debris office. Take us through what we have. There's a lump of aluminium here which looks slightly mangled. What's happened to it?
It was the victim of a ground test that was done close to here in Freiburg by the Ernst Mach Institute, and they have what we call a light gas gun. So this is a special gun that has a capability to accelerate objects up to 6 kilometers per second. So this is not quite the velocity that we have up there, but it's coming close. And they accelerated a sphere of 1 centimeter diameter. I have it in my hand here. It's an aluminium ball, and this was shot onto this aluminium plate. It's a very thick plate of about 10 centimeter thickness, and you can see that it punched a crater of about 5 centimeter deepness, and you even see that we have some spallation effects on the other side, so even the other side is somehow affected. The shockwave went through and separated some materials on the other side. The real sphere, of course, that's not available anymore. That was pulverized and became liquid and disappeared in droplets and gaseous form. And of course, you can imagine that if you hold this is a couple of kilograms, you cannot equip your spacecraft with walls like that. So it shows we have a problem. Even small bullets like this 1 centimeter sphere, of which we have 600,000 up there, they cannot be shielded with such kind of thing. Still, we need to do something in order to protect manned modules in particular, where astronauts stay in, like the ISS, the International Space Station. And here, engineers developed something clever, and we call it a double shield or a Whipple shield. Whipple is an American scientist who developed this kind of shield. And he came up with the idea, why don't we use the energy of the object in order to destroy it? This is done by just exposing a very, very thin aluminium plate to the environment outside, which is sacrificed and which is punched. But at the same time, the object is also destroyed and translated into a number of very small liquid droplets. And this cloud of liquid droplets can then easily be stopped by a second plate, which is just behind, 5-6 centimeters behind, and not very thick. And if you hold this is very lightweight, this is a couple of grams. And this is something you can use in space. And actually, space station and also the ATV, they are equipped with these kinds of protection shields.
Just so that listeners can see, there is actually going to be a video of both of these little shields on the website as well. Now, I'm just looking through the window here. There's not many people in this room at the moment. A lot of computer screens, half a dozen. And there's someone very vigorously vacuuming underneath all the desks and everything. I'm hoping she's not disconnecting anything because moving bits around. You must get worried about people moving stuff around here. I also noticed there's
There's eight clocks on the wall with different times. And what, I'm curious, one of them's called Wallop. What's that?
That's Wallops. That's one of the ground stations that we have. So which of the...
I'm Nick Mardle. I'm the spacecraft operations manager for Cryosat 2. So, welcome to the Earth Observation DCR, a dedicated control room. And in here, we do all the routine day-to-day operations for currently four missions. That's ERS, Envisat, Cryosat, and Gucci. And this is where we live, so the four missions all live together.
Are the spacecraft all monitored all of the time? Is there any moment where someone isn't looking at some screen to make sure that it's all right?
Well, for Earth observation, that's a very pertinent question, because in fact we only see the spacecraft for somewhere between 6 and 10 minutes every orbit, out of around 100 minutes. So most of the time the spacecraft isn't in visibility anyway. So part of the job is to look at the data that's been stored while it's not in visibility, downlink it, and then check it that everything that happened out of visibility was okay.
This is a real-life spacecraft controller. This is Asha. She controls Cryosat and Gucci for us.
There's a lot of lines of code on there. I don't know what any of it means, but it looks impressive. Whilst we're waiting for the acquisition of signal from Cryosat, Nick, why don't you take us through the mission? Cryosat, what does it do? What's it looking for?
Okay, well, Cryosat was launched on April the 8th of 2010, and it's an ice trending mission. So it's there to measure the ice thickness and ice heights of the various areas around the world for sea ice and land ice and transitional ice. And it's not just an instantaneous measurement, it's really looking for the trends. So you can take one measurement today, but it doesn't mean anything. What you have to do is repeat that measurement throughout the season, throughout the years, to see really what's happening with the ice, whether it's melting, whether it's thickening, where it's thickening and where it's thinning. And from that, the scientists will be able to take the data and make much better predictions about the influence of the ice changes, whether indeed, as we most people now believe, the ice in the North Pole is thinning. But what does that really mean for us?
Network cluster. Cluster network. Okay, you can break track.
We've got 25 seconds to go. So should we wait for the signal? I'm really curious now. It's quite exciting, this. So this is the sound of Cryosat calling home, basically. What is it telling us, and what's going to happen next?
Basically, the first thing that we see is the real-time telemetry. And in that, there's a summary of how many major out-of-limits there have been, how many major events have been recorded on board. And we can see that. But before we can understand what they are, we have to wait for the uplink from the station to be generated and radiated.
So the boxes on there have all gone green now, which means you're talking to the satellite. How long will they stay green for?
Until we reach 5 degrees descending. So we should get this for another 8 or so minutes. We've started the major task off already. This is the downlink of the stored data. And that's being sent, as I said, 100 megabits per second on the X-band link, which we switched on before the pass. And this is all being acquired at the payload data segment in Kiruna.
And for all these space history fans out there, this is orbit number 4758 of Cryosat that we're talking about here. So, you know, in the future, if something happens that's discovered on this orbit, remember, we were recording at this very time.
Hello, you're listening to a special edition of Science Weekly recorded in Germany.
So this is the control room of the drop tower. So we call it our tiny little Houston control. And actually it's arranged in a comparable way. On the upper desk, this is the desk where the drop tower operators control their system and prepare everything for dropping.
Can you tell me what we can see on the screen here? There are four separate images up there.
What we see are different images from inside of the drop tube. Down left, we see a view from the tip of the tower, from the top of the tower, down to the deceleration area. Mm-hmm. And actually, in the center, you can see the drop capsule of today, which is on the catapult post and is not already charged. So within the next minutes, it will be pulled down to the launch position.
I see.
And at the lower end, you see the edge of the deceleration container. So when the capsule is on its way up to the top of the tower and falling back, This deceleration container is released and will swing underneath the tube and catch the caps.
Okay, experiment might happen within the next few seconds. You see that the operator is pushing a button, opening the window for the experimenter to initiate the experiment whenever ready. That's always a rather exciting moment, even though everything is then done within seconds. Now you see it going. Container moves. Capsule is falling back, hitting the container. Everything was fine.
Fantastic. What did we see there? Take me through what we saw there.
So we saw the capsule coming out of the hole, of the catapult hole. The capsule, that's always very exciting because the diameter of the capsule is almost the same as the hole where it comes out, so it's a very narrow gap. And then we saw it running to the top of the tower, and it's approaching the upper end for about 1 or 1.5 meters, so it's going very closely to the real end, and then turning back.
And in this case, we saw this this collection of tiny particles that the camera was videoing, and then as soon as the experiment was launched, they were all moving around, and it's that movement that they'll be analysing, I suppose.
You should ask the experimenter how they evaluate it. I don't know how to evaluate that. It looked rather chaotic, but maybe it wasn't.
You can relive that by watching a video that producer Andy's making right now. That'll go up on The Guardian's website this week. The links will be on our blog. Yep, Andy's nodding. Now, as you can hear, they're pumping the air back into the tower and that enormous vacuum they had to create. So while they're doing that and making it safe for us to go inside so we can look at whether the experiment survived, let's quickly nip across the complex here at ZARM to a place that's controlling part of the International Space Station.
Welcome to the ground station in Bremen. My name is Jörg Klatte and I'm currently working on the fluid experiment on board the ISS.
So you have an experiment on the space station that you're controlling from this room in Bremen?
Yes, so we have a direct connection. We can send commands from this ground station to the ISS. It goes through the NASA loops and directly goes to our experiment.
So can we see any of the experiment on the screen, or is this, what are we looking at here?
So we can see the experiment on the right-hand side, and this is a live picture of the experiment right now.
What are we seeing in this other image on the left? I think I know, but you can explain it to people listening.
So right now we can see the shuttle, which is docked at the ISS. It just arrived there.
And that's the Earth spinning away behind it.
Okay. And just a little bit more now, I've got Chrissy sitting observation.
So when you want to send a command to your experiment, how do you actually get in touch with the experiment from here in Bremen?
So this computer has a VPN connection to Huntsville, the control center, and they send this command to the ISS.
You're wondering if people can hack the experiment. So,
So this computer is not connected to the local internet. And they set up an internet connection just for this specific computer. And we have about 10 passwords, which change every week. It's very high security. So we actually have different keys here, which are nobody else has except us, and so there are quite some security issues here.
Okay, before we accidentally take the ISS out of orbit, let's head back to the drop tower and see if that experiment that they catapulted up is still in one piece.
Now we lift off the main entrance into the vacuum container. Now the hydraulic system pushes the door off the ceiling, and then the door is lifted up, and then the bridge is released, and we can enter it.
You're saying that some of the experiments you fire up weigh about half a ton. What happens when they land?
The deceleration of the experiment, of course we do not want to destruct the experiment because we want to drop it many times. It is landing in a big container filled with polystyrene grain, polystyrene pellets, 3 to 5 millimeter, very small pellets.
And this serves for gentle deceleration. Gentle means 35G, which is would be quite hard for us, but for the experiment, it's no problem. We run experiments with normal laboratory equipment, with normal computers, with very delicate instruments like laser interferometers or so, without being in need to realign and readjust everything after each drop. So 35G is not sounds much, is not very much.
And this 2,000 square meters actually are multiplied by a factor, I don't know, close to infinity, by the polystyrene grain. I mean, that's a lot of surface. So if you put too much humidity... The sound you hear is the sled coming down from the top of the tower. It's connected to the sled and then pulled out of the grain.
So the experiment is somewhere in here?
It's somewhere in here, exactly.
Underneath an awful lot of polystyrene balls?
Yes.
What's he doing now?
There is a lot of polystyrene grain on the rear side. And due to electrostatic force, it's sticking to the cover, and this needs to be blown away. And maybe we are lucky, and then we can see even sparks when he touches the cover, maybe.
Actually, we are not allowed to drop a capsule in air, because the electrostatic sparks would be that strong that it would immediately be inflamed or burning.
Yeah.
And if this starts burning, it will be hard to extinguish because there's a lot of gas in. It's practically impossible. Now you see the container is going off.
Does it ever go wrong?
Actually, at the very beginning of our drop tower operation, we had a failure, which was not that the deceleration didn't work properly, but the deceleration container should be underneath the drop line, and it wasn't at that time.
Isn't that quite fundamental?
Yeah, that was a basic mistake at the very beginning.
So what happened?
Yeah, what shall happen? We smashed the experiment.
Right, it's over and out from Zaam here in Bremen. I'm going to head to catch the train to my next glamorous location. So I'm going to hand you back to Alok again for a few moments. I think he's still in Darmstadt.
So I'm in one of these fantastic European canteens. We don't get these things in the UK, in science labs. They take their lunch very seriously here in Europe, and none more so than the European Space Operations Centre. And I'm here with Andreas. Andreas, introduce yourself to us and tell us what you do here.
My name is Andreas Schepers. I'm a communication officer with the European Space Agency.
How interested are members of the public in science here?
People just love everything that has to do with stars. There's a certain interest in the German public for science, of course, yeah.
Now, we thought we'd get away from Britain and from the sort of science personalities we've got there, but apparently Brian Cox has made his way over here as well.
Oh, yeah. Brian Cox has, let's say, at least he's well known in the area of science communication, space science communication. His TV show, Wonders of the Solar System, has been adapted for the German market and has been broadcast recently, I guess.
You didn't like the adaptation, though?
I found the adaptation a little bit disappointing because they actually inserted German scientists to comment on different aspects of the show, or different topics, and in my opinion they pretty much destroyed the original look and feel of the of each episode.
Do you think that German scientists, German science gets enough prominence outside this country?
Ooh, that's a hard question. I think there is no real language issue here, because most of the science is done in English anyway. So there might be a problem with science communication. I mean, the whole field of science communication is undergoing an interesting development right now. So it's being professionalized right now. And maybe it's still focusing, of course, on the German public, on the German government as well, because it's still the German government that funds much of the research which is done. But, of course, there are also European-wide funding programs for science. And Yeah, maybe it's rather a communication problem than a problem, an original problem of the scientists.
On the menu was Coq au Vin. There was schnitzel, obviously. We're in Germany. But I'm going for breaded chicken. It's like a turkey burger you used to get for tea when you were 14.
The public really understands what we're doing. They really see the benefit for our cultural heritage. And so they're really into that, and they're really encouraging us to do the research we're doing.
We definitely, as scientists, have to do a bit more to communicate why we do this and why it is important to the general society, be it either for climatic research or other major issues that we're discussing.
Hello, ich heiße Andrew Purcell.
Hello, my name's Andrew Purcell. I've been teaching in Germany for the last 2 years, and I'm now at Imperial College London doing a postgraduate course.
Studiere zurzeit bei Imperial College London.
The primary difference between UK and German education system regarding science is really the lack of the dichotomy which we have between the sciences and the humanities. The whole sort of two cultures debate doesn't really exist. Quite an interesting point is that the German word for science is Wissenschaft. Wissenschaft, if you sort of break that down into its substituent parts, kind of means knowledge making. And that's used much more liberally than we would use the word science over here. So this can be applied to a whole range of themes which we might traditionally sort of associate not with science but with the humanities. They don't really have a proper word for humanities. So you'd have to think about talking about Geisteswissenschaften, which is a strange word because it kind of means like the soul sciences. You know, when we're talking about Alzheimer's disease, we don't necessarily think, oh, here's the link. From my experience having taught in Germany, I really found that they use the sort of history of science, or even the sort of the philosophy of science, as a real good hook to get people interested in science from quite an early age. And they would always refer to it as the Geiger-Müller-Zähler rule, which means the Geiger-Müller tube counter. Obviously they have Einstein, but you know, there's a whole swathe of scientists that you talk about, whether it's Max Planck or Heisenberg. A big part of this is sort of emphasizing, you know, the great culture that Germany has and the great tradition they have in producing, you know, world-leading scientists.
A common word for this would always be Röntgenstrahlung, meaning Röntgen rays, whereas we would traditionally talk about x-rays. So they really do emphasize that tradition wherever possible.
Hello, you're listening to a special edition of Science Weekly recorded in Germany.
Right, I've just got off the train from Bremen. I've come to the Max Planck Institute for the Biology of Aging in Cologne. It was a bit of a high-speed trip here. The speedometer on the taxi, I looked as we just went over the Rhine, and it was touching about 140 kilometres an hour, which I make to be about 85 miles an hour. Anyway, efficiency as ever, we got here on time. I've come here because it's the newest Max Planck Institute in Germany. And I have to say, it's so new, it's not even been built yet. I've climbed up on a neighbouring building just to look over it. You can probably hear the building work going on behind me. There are at least four cranes I can see just from here, busy at work putting up new buildings by the looks of things. In fact, just on the building I've climbed up on, I can see an enormous hook being delivered down by one of the cranes, so I should probably get moving.
Yeah, hello, my name is Ralf Petri.
I'm here to meet Ralf Petri. He's the scientific coordinator at the Max Planck Institute for the Biology of Aging. I'm hoping he can tell me a little bit about this new institute and some of the science that they're doing here.
So the Max Planck Society is somewhat unique, even in Germany. So the reason is... there are a couple of research associations in Germany that are focused on, for example, applied research, which would be Fraunhofer Society. Max Planck is on quite the other side, so it's focused on basic research, the fundamental questions of science. So we see ourselves as standing at the very forefront of science and trying to poke in the mist before us to find something. One unique thing of the Max Planck Society, which is the head organization of 80 institutes, there is the so-called Harnack principle, one of the forefathers of the Max Planck Society, who said that the science has to be the focus of research, so of the institutes, basically. So the scientific departments are built around a scientific director. And if this director decides from one day to the next he wants to do something different, so, for example, changing the model organisms or something like that, he can do that.
Just give me an idea of who actually comes to a Max Planck Institute. You don't presumably do undergraduate teaching?
No, we don't do undergraduate teaching. Some of the directors like to do that, and they have the opportunity to do so. But usually we're starting, well, a PhD graduate school is the first entry point in most of the Max Planck Institutes. This is a very good starting point for postdocs that want to pursue a career in academic science. And since we have very good labs and very good heads of departments, this is a very good starting point.
So, Ralph, you mentioned you've got some labs here. Should we go and have a quick look at them?
Yeah, sure.
So that's where you keep the stocks.
Ah, right. So this is a room kept at a warm temperature, I presume, is it?
Yeah.
And what's going on in there?
Yeah, it's just to keep the stocks because you can't just freeze and thaw flies, because you have to keep them going. And we have constant temperature rooms here to keep the stocks. And we change the food and put them or raise the population again.
A lot of these, they're not moving, are they? Oh, some of them are. Are these, what are we looking at? Are they living flies or...?
Yeah, they are. These are living flies.
Okay.
We have like 300 different theories why we age. And all of them have something to it, but none of them describes it. And so we are working on that. And of course, in the long run, I mean, aging is probably the most dangerous risk for diseases we have. And we know that a lot of diseases like cancer, cardiovascular, Alzheimer's, and so on are related to aging. And if we can stop that aging process, would be too much, but if we can influence the aging process, it would help us to understand diseases like that and to treat them in the long run. So far, it has been a strategy, well, you have cancer, so you design a cancer treatment or a strategy to treat cancer. What we think is, if you treat aging, you treat a lot of different diseases at once, or with one shot, basically.
So it's like super preventative medicine, in a sense, is instead of developing drugs for Alzheimer's, for all of these other things, if you can reduce the risk factor for all of those, which, as you say, aging being it, it's interesting to think of aging as a risk factor itself. Fruit flies, C. elegans, which is a nematode worm, and yeast. And do you know how long, roughly, you've extended their lifespans?
Well, in the best cases, you can extend lifespan up to 5 or 10-fold even.
Right.
But this only works with very simple organisms.
So, Ralph, what have we got here in front of us?
Yeah, this is sort of like an adhesive stripe here.
Flypaper.
So it's a fly, flypaper.
So that catches any strays.
Yeah.
And so this is the sort of ultraviolet fly trap that we're used to seeing at home in sort of kebab shops. So they sort of hit the electrified grill behind it, presumably, and then drop down. So that's someone's work in there.
Yeah, it is. Months of work.
Ich bin Bianca Habermann. I'm the bioinformatics group leader here at the Max Planck Institute for Biology of Aging. And I'm here since last April, so one of the new recruits here.
How hard do you think this this question of what's going on with the science of aging, how hard do you think a puzzle that's going to be to understand? How is it something that we're going to, or that you're going to help understand in the next, say, 10, 20 years, or is it going to be far more intractable than that?
I think science proves itself always to be intractable, so it probably will take longer than that to really figure out what's going on. I mean, biology is very complex, right? So it's not always a single pathway or a single gene which is responsible for something. So you always have to see also the complexity of the phenomenon. In this case, it's aging, so it probably will take longer.
Well, after that whistle-stop tour of a rather large country, I'm reunited here with Ian. How was your trip, Ian? What did you think of German science?
Good. Tiring trip, but impressive. My first time here, and one of the overriding feelings I got was that the German government does genuinely seem to be four square behind science. I don't know if you picked up the same thing. There are always reasons to moan about funding, but there seems to be good money going into German science, and it seems that the country's decided that it's a way of securing their future.
It's an interesting way it's set up as well, isn't it? There are several streams for different types of institution.
So you have all of your universities, and they vary as much as any country's universities, from the top-notch to the mediocre. But then you have these more applied institutes where people are working stuff which is technology very close to market, and that kind of draws on Germany's real industrial heritage, I think. And then the other ones, sort of at the other end of the spectrum, if you like, the real basic science, real cutting edge of basic science research are these Max Planck institutes, where the entire concept is based around throwing money at a bunch of directors who have a common vision. And the nice thing about that is they can choose from one day to the next where to put their money, what research to do. They don't have to answer to a load of funding bodies, and to they're not sluggish as the universities or these other places. They can go where they really want to go, and makes them really competitive.
One of the things that Germany is obviously very famous for is its history. One of the people I spoke to was Dieter Hoffmann at the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science in Berlin. He waxed lyrical about the golden age of German science. This is the early 20th century when Max Planck and Werner Heisenberg, Einstein, Schrödinger, these people were coming up with the stuff that essentially broke physics, classical physics, so general relativity, special relativity, quantum mechanics. And they laid the foundations for the 20th century when it came to physics, which then moved, of course, during and after the war, it moved to America. But, I mean, at some point they're going to try and grab it back, aren't they?
They will want it back, and they're doing a lot to go in that direction. I mean, everywhere had a vision of what they were going to do. But just going back to the point you raised, we hear an awful lot about Max Planck as we moved around Germany, but we didn't hear so much about Einstein. Where's he in all of this?
Well, clearly Einstein is a colossus of physics, and if you speak to any physicist in Germany, he's the gold standard. He's up there with Planck and Heisenberg and everyone else. I mean, Einstein is claimed by the US nowadays, really. I mean, he spent his last days in Princeton at the Institute of Advanced Study, and he left for the reason that many Jewish scientists left before the Second World War. And afterwards, he kind of severed contact with Germany. His will, all of his licenses for his name to be used anywhere, are now with the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Now, it's not that Germany doesn't want to celebrate Einstein, and I think there's even an Einstein Foundation that's been set up recently to try and get his name back into things. But I think it's obviously something that will happen. It's a delicate situation. Talking of the future, though, it's bright for Germany, isn't it?
I think it is. I mean, there are certainly a lot of scientists from other countries being drawn to Germany. They're definitely establishing themselves as one of the foremost places to go to do science. And it's not surprising why that is, because of the money. I mean, another Max Planck Institute that is being discussed at the moment is going to focus on artificial life. And of course, that's synthetic biology, and that whole area is cutting edge. You just have to walk around one of the university campuses to see the buildings going up. And they aren't average buildings. These are top-notch facilities going up that really drives the message home that they are going for science in a very big way.
And behind this building you see already faint some buildings. This is OHB company, which is the largest German space company.
I think we are pretty well off with the system we have, and part of that is stability in the system. So it's not that you're funded as a junior group leader, for example, funded for 3 years and then you can try to find funds for your own position, but you have a longer perspective. It's not that you have to write an application every 2 years to fund your own position, and that's gives us more planning security.
Bright people attract bright people.
A big issue is the way in which science is directly applied to the economy in Germany. I mean, this is something which we kind of picked up on last year in the UK, when there was the whole sort of science is vital campaign. You know, a couple of thousand scientists went to Whitehall and made this sort of economic argument for funding science. And in Germany, obviously, science funding has been increased recently.
Of course, we benefit from the fact that Merkel has a scientific education as well. And we also, here in North Rhine-Westphalia, we really were lucky to have a government that was into science and tried to push science forward, because they see that as an investment in the future. This is a good time for scientists here in Germany.
The whole idea of like applied science is just huge, in a way that we don't seem to really get in this country. That, you know, science can actually just almost single-handedly just drive the economy.
The red building is Fraunhofer Institute for Material Science. The other red building is Max Planck Institute for Marine Microbiology.
We nevertheless have some trouble to compete for excellent scientists in the worldwide competition, and one of the reasons is that we are locked into a certain tariff system. So it's, in the end, it's money. So we can't pay that high as compared to US, for example. Our strengths are the institutes, the scientific environments, and you see the new one there. It's a 60 million building which offers the top-notch technology, everything's there, everything is planned according to the needs of our scientists, and I think that's really unique.
There's a lot going on, mm-hmm. A lot of buildings coming up.
So I just know the second place, which is the Center of Excellence in Cologne.
The strongest competitors are, of course, the USA and UK. And I think, funny enough, one of the reasons is the language, because everybody is horrified by the imagination to learn German, which I can understand.
On this side, this is the university campus until the street in front of the white building there and behind this hammer building. And around here, this is the so-called technology park.
In the long run, I also see East Asian countries as competitors. China is catching up quickly. But also, like, Singapore is a great place to do science, and the Scandinavian countries and Switzerland.
This is a construction site of the new International School of Bremen.
That's really international, and in terms of staff, we have a rate of like 55% to 60% of foreigners in the institute from 25 nations, from among 100 people now.
The word that Germany is a good place to be for a scientist has got out.
Yeah, I think especially Cologne is a very good place, because this is a very liberal city, and the people here make it easier for them to adapt. And especially the carnival that is coming up now.
That's it from Germany. Thanks to everyone involved in this podcast, including our wonderful listeners, for helping point us to some of the most interesting science going on here. We know we're only scratching the surface. Of course, we ought to say thanks for everyone in Germany being able to speak such wonderful English too. We try not to take it for granted. Don't forget, throughout this week, you'll be able to watch those videos we made at ESOP in Darmstadt and at ZARM as well, Bremen's drop tower. The links to those and everything else you've heard can be found on our blog, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly.
This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth and presented by Alok Jha
and Ian Sample. Danke fürs Zuhören.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.